This morning, we're talking about the Octavia Butler Celebration of the Arts and Activism Symposium taking place at Spelman College on April 16th. This event, presented by the Cosby Chair and author Tananarive Due, who will join us this morning, along with panelist Dream Hampton, a journalist, author, and community activist, and Adrienne Marie Brown, the co-editor of Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction from Social Justice Movements. So this morning, we're indulging in something broadly referred to as Afrofuturism. Think about artists such as Parliament Funkadelic, Samuel Delaney, even the art of Jean-Michel Basquiat. These are all artists whose work actively portray Black people and Black culture through a techno-diverse science fiction lens, melding fantasy and science fiction to the cultural mores in the African diaspora. Ms. Due, thank you so much for joining us on The Local Take this morning.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to start. The first book that I read by Octavia Butler was Wild Seed, about the African immortal who had lived over 500 years. And that was enough to hook me on her books. Can you share with us the first work of hers that you read?
You know, actually, I do believe it was Wild Seed, because at the time, either that or Mind of My Mind,
okay,
I was writing a novel called My Soul to Keep, which was about an immortal African. And someone said, oh, have you read Octavia Butler's novel about an immortal African? And I was so aghast and terrified that I was retreading, you know, all the ground. But when I read her, I was really pleasantly surprised to learn that her book was very, very different. And I was so glad to learn that she was in the field.
It's a very different story than My Soul to Keep, but the theme of immortality of Africanness is true, I think.
Well, and clearly we're both reaching for something in that. I think there's been so much absence of Africa in our popular culture that I know that's why I was inspired to create a specifically African character, that sense of history, ancientness, and also having gifts beyond what we have.
Which you can always find in fantasy. And that leads me to my next question. Why do you think it's so hard for folks in our general community to expect there to be diversity in the future? And I'm thinking about the controversy over the character Rue in The Hunger Games, or even to something like, you know, the trashing of Pluto Nash. I mean, it wasn't that great, but it wasn't that bad either.
You know, and I think After Earth got a little bashing that wasn't deserved as well. I mean, it's a father-son film about a boy surviving and helping his father in space. You know, I don't know if the blowback is more from our community. I think really it has been established more traditionally, externally, that we have just been absent from the future. And perhaps, you know, as African Americans, maybe we're tough on some of the first to try to stick their heads up, you know, and change the imagery. But I think the reason we're tough is because there's just such a hunger to be represented, to see ourselves in the future and see ourselves in the future done well. And I think the time is here. There are a lot of writers. I can't even invite all the writers I'd like to Spelman, because there are so many who are content creators. They're in film, they're in television, they're in books, and we are going to start to see a change.
Well, that brings me to my next question. I know that you produced a film of your series, the Living Blood series. Do you see a big budget Hollywood production of that, or at least Netflix?
Well, My Soul to Keep and my African Immortal series have been in and out of film development for years. And I co-produced with my husband, Stephen Barnes, and a director, Lucina Fisher, a very good friend of mine, a short film called Danger Word, which is not set in my African Immortal community. It's based on a zombie short story that Steve and I wrote years ago before The Walking Dead. But the reason we did it was to learn the skills we would need to produce a feature. If it came to that, My Soul to Keep is still being shopped. There are very smart people trying to find a home for it. But even though times are changing, I do think it might be difficult as a studio sell. So, and that's where having a filmmaker like Ava DuVernay come in last year at Spelman was so inspirational, because she really puts that fire under you. Why are you waiting for Hollywood? Do it yourself. So we took those lessons to heart, learned the skills. So we didn't start with the feature. We started with baby steps. It's an 18-minute movie called Danger Word. We'll be releasing online soon. And from that, we've learned the lesson to hopefully move on to the next feature.
Well, now, as the Octavia Butler celebration continues to grow, what do you hope to gain by hosting these events? You're saying this year there are more writers than you can invite. Where do you expect the symposium to go?
Well, this is my last year at Spelman as the Cosby Chair in the Humanities. And I had not planned to have an Octavia Butler celebration each of the 2 years, but last year's was so successful and there was so much interest in it, not just in Atlanta, but I would say around the country. There's a growing interest in Octavia's work in Afrofuturism, and I started to notice this social justice bent. So while last year's event was more about people who knew Octavia, worked with Octavia, her first teachers, her first mentors, her friends, this year, some of the panelists did not know Octavia personally. They only know of her work. But I really wanted to serve as a way to help build a community. I learned as a Black speculative fiction writer myself that we have power in numbers. There are many more of us than when I first started publishing, and certainly since my husband, Stephen Barnes, started publishing long before I did. So we're there, but I'd like us to find each other. I think magic happens when you put people in a room together, when you have conversations, and you can live stream it and share ideas and inspiration, because so often artists feel like they're alone, but we're not, and we're all toiling under Octavia's spirit. I think many of us are trying to create a better world, images of ourselves in the future, images of ourselves in the past, magic, all involving community building and repair for the damage that has been done to us.
Well, that brings us to the theme of this year's symposium, Art and Activism. And your life and your family have always been involved in activism. And I know recently you were part of bringing justice to the victims of the Florida Boys School.
Well, I am very blessed to have come from a civil rights family. My late mother, Patricia Stevens Due, was in and out of jail and was part of a landmark jail in 1960. My father, John Due, who is still living, is a civil rights attorney. They really did instill in me that desire to build a better world and also to be able to watch up close that individuals can change the world. That was not an idea to me. That was my parents. They can help change the world. And I was also very lucky that when I started writing my little horror stories and my little science fiction spaceship stories, they did not discourage me. They did not tell me, get my head out of the clouds and march my feet on the ground. They embraced me as an artist. And although I do try to have messages in my work, like say the war on drugs, I talk about that and Blood Colony and My Soul to Take, which are novels where magical blood has been made illegal because it can heal, to sort of make us look at our society and say, okay, what? Look at our prison system, what's going on with our drug policy. But there are other artists on this panel who've been arrested. Bree Newsom was arrested at a sit-in protesting a change in voting rights. Juno Diaz is very active in education and immigration. Adrienne Marie Brown, Dream Hampton. These are artists who also walk the walk in a way that reminds me of my parents. It's not the same way. It's not always a protest sign anymore. In fact, if you ask 10 people, they'll name 10 different issues that are the most important issue facing the Black community. So there isn't that sense in the 60s necessarily of sort of a unified march towards civil rights, but there are so many issues that we all embrace in our own way. I can't wait to hear how all these different artists will discuss how they view their role in changing the world and creating that change that Octavia Butler writes about in Parable of the Sower.
Well, Ms. Due, I just want to thank you so much for joining us this morning to talk about the upcoming symposium. We're going to be talking with Adrienne Marie Brown and Dream Hampton as well. And
yeah.
I just wish you luck with the symposium. And hopefully you'll figure out a way to do it again next year, even if it isn't at Spelman.
Well, maybe so. There's definitely a lot of interest in it. And I would not be surprised if you keep seeing Octavia Butler tributes popping up all over the country.
Thank you again. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Local Take with Kiplin Primus. Kiplin is talking to women participating in next week's Octavia Butler Celebration of Fantastic Arts Symposium on Art and Activism, taking place Wednesday, April 16th at Spelman College. This is the Public Affairs Block on WCLK.
Ms. Adrienne Marie Brown, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're asking everyone.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. We're asking everyone to tell us about their introduction to Octavia Butler. What was your first book?
My first book was The Parable of the Sower, and I read her work when I was still a teenager and remember being really impacted by the idea of having this young Black female protagonist who was not just surviving the conditions around her, but was actually shaping the world around her and had an entire new religion inside of her. I was very excited by that.
So how did it make you feel? Because it's not often that we find works of art that project African Americans in the future at all.
Yeah, you know, it made me feel like the way that I saw myself and the way that I saw my family, I came from a mixed race family that was in the military, and it made it feel like the kind of young woman that I was automatically powerful, could have an influence on the world around me. I was in a very, you know, sort of authoritarian environment, and I didn't quite fit from a very early age. I was very, tried to kind of even describe it in a nice way, just anti-authoritarian, you know. I had a lot of ideas of my own and didn't want to wear a uniform, didn't understand why anyone did, and that had to do with democracy, and really wanted to see things go towards justice from a very young age. And it was just an exciting phase to be in then, to read her work and see that a Black person could be the protagonist, and that her vision was broader. It wasn't just uplifting Black people, but it was uplifting all of humanity, that all of humanity had to rely on a vision that came from a young Black woman. It was very powerful.
Her books are very powerful. In your upcoming book, Octavia's Brood, can you tell us about the book and the participants in it?
Totally. So it is an anthology of original science fiction from people who do social justice work. And my co-editor, Walida Imarisha, and I came up with the idea a few years ago because we were both turning to science fiction repeatedly to expand our visions and to expand the way we were having conversations about the world, and realized that that was happening all around us. And it made us really excited to think of what the impact of that could be on social justice work, that people who are in the trenches trying to change the world every day actually came up with new ideas and new stories for what the future could look like based on some of their best work today. So the participants are all people who have been organizers, are working directly with communities, and are communicators, are really thinking about what it is that is limiting us in terms of how we see the future of the world and what we need to open or expand in order to really be visionary. We call the work visionary fiction, which encompasses science fiction or fantasy. We just wanted to open the door so that no one would be left out of the conversation. So the stories are very, very inspiring and very different. You know, like we have a story about a future in which the president announces that we don't have enough oil for people to continue traveling freely, and we get to look inside the mind of a young woman as she decides what she's going to do and how she's, you know, where she's going to live, basically whether she wants to live in the world that she's created for herself or whether she wants to go back and live with her family and build her life close to them because she otherwise will be basically choosing something else. There's a step that we all deal with now, making these kind of choices, but we take for granted, I think, some of the mobility a lot of us have. Yeah, we have a zombie apocalypse, immigration story, and just very interesting juxtapositions of tropes and new ideas.
I think it's very interesting the way people are able to use science fiction and fantasy to kind of solve problems or challenges that we're having today.
Exactly. I'm actually hosting a workshop at my home today in Detroit. It's a part of a series of workshops where I have Detroiters coming together to generate science fiction together, collectively. This is something that Walida and I started doing as part of the workshops that we've been traveling around, and it has been just really thrilling to see that it wasn't just the people who submitted their stories for the anthology, but everyone we meet has these entire worlds within them. And if you ask the right question, you can get that to start to pour out. But tonight we'll be doing another of those workshops here, and each one, we basically build a world together and then write a series of stories within it. And I'm going to be publishing that work as well sometime later this year. And that's just, it's just an exciting project. I can't wait for people to read these stories.
It sounds very exciting. Now, I'm more familiar with your poetry that's about time travel and fantasy. Where does your inspiration come from? As you say, do we all have these worlds within us?
I get very inspired by the people and things that are going on around me. I live in Detroit, which is a very epic narrative story. In every direction, you've got folks who are survivors of apocalyptic conditions, and I'm really interested in what we can learn as a country, as a species, from how people have survived here and are surviving now. It's a very, very hard time to live in Detroit. It's a very hard time to be here, and yet there are incredible innovations, incredible stories still happening here. And people coming up with, you know, ways to feed themselves, ways to take care of their families in the midst of extremely hard winters and hard conditions. And there's a community that I'm a part of here, the Allied Media Project, Allied Media Community. They talk about how the most innovative solutions come from those places where people have the scarcest resources, because then you know it can work in any condition. And Detroit is kind of the epicenter of that in the U.S. right now. So I feel like I get a lot of inspiration just from living here and talking to people, asking about people's stories, bringing folks together to share their stories with each other. And then I do a lot of social justice facilitation. So I'm constantly hearing from people who are everyday heroes, basically, folks who have chosen to spend their lives trying to improve the conditions of their community, of their family, of their own lives. So I'm surrounded by people who inspire me, and they make it so that I can't help but write.
I love that. I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning to talk about the Octavia Butler Symposium. Can you tell us again where folks can get information about Octavia's Brood?
Yeah, octaviasbrood.com is the website. We also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/Octavia's Brood. And there's been an Indiegogo campaign and some other stuff. So if you Google it, you'll be able to find it.
And it's coming out in June, right?
Yeah, June. We're aiming for Octavia's birthday, actually, June 25th.
Well, thank you, Ms. Brown. We've talked with Ms. Dew, and we'll be talking with Ms. Hampton, some of the panelists that will be with you next week.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You're listening to The Local Take with Kiplin Primus. Kiplin is talking to women participating in next week's Octavia Butler Celebration of Fantastic Arts Symposium on Art and Activism, taking place Wednesday, April 16th at Spelman College. This is the Public Affairs Block on WCLK.
Dream Hampton, welcome to The Local Take, and thanks so much for joining our conversation about Octavia Butler and Afrofuturism.
Thank you. I'm thrilled.
Well, we've been asking everyone to tell us about their introduction to Octavia Butler. What was your first story?
I think that, like most people, Kindred was my first story that I read by Octavia Butler. I was a teenager. I believe I was living in Atlanta. I had this period after high school and right before college at NYU where I lived in Atlanta. It may have been 1989. And I had never come across any fiction like hers. At the time, you know, at the end of the 80s, that entire decade, I feel like, was a booming time for Black women authors. So just coming of age in that era, I was reading all of the Black women authors who we all know now, Alice Walker and Toni Morrison.
Gloria Naylor.
Gloria Naylor and Toni K. Bambara.
All those good books. Dave.
Yeah, so I was reading all of those wonderful books, and I think that's how I made my way to Octavia, although she's not necessarily on that same map for everyone. But I read Kindred first, which of course is set in kind of modern times, the woman in an interracial relationship who slips into these time warp where she ends up on a plantation in this parallel universe. So that was my first introduction to Octavia.
What did it make you feel like to see an author in the fantasy area kind of work with African Americans?
Well, you know, I had never, and of course I went deeper and I read all of her work, and particularly the Xenogenesis trilogy, which is hardcore science. I had never really come across any women writers who were writing science fiction. My mom definitely read Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein. I remember the Dune books, kind of the paperbacks in our home as a kid, and I remember reading some of them. And of course, I loved Madeline Zangle's
Wrinkle in Time.
Yes, Wrinkle in Time. So I loved fantasy as a child. I must have read that book a dozen times. And some of Octavia's work is better categorized as fantasy. But the Xenogenesis trilogy, which would fall more in like a hardcore science fiction category, like Asimov and Robert Heinlein, was mind-blowing for me. I mean, I'd read Donna Haraway, who does theory on cyborg and different kind of sci-fi. She uses it to talk about gender, but I'd not read a woman who was taking the fiction on. And it was just mind-blowing and beautiful and utterly different. Her humanity is so staggering. Her idea isn't that we are going to be threatened by these enslaving aliens' superior technology. She really has a far more kind of open idea about what encounter would mean.
That it's just a change in humanity. It's not a destruction of humanity.
Well, I mean, and sometimes the destruction is inferred. I wouldn't say that Dawn and the Xenogenesis trilogy is necessarily all good for humanity. But
we survived.
We survived, and it's about changing. And she also, I don't think, she's an anti-hierarchist, so she doesn't have these ideas about humanity being the very best thing that there is, which is radical, you know?
It is, it is. The theme of this year's symposium is art and activism. And Dream, your name, your life, it seems to be your birthright. Is that something you couldn't escape, or is that something that you just embrace?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's ancestral, but I did come to it honestly. I'm a child in the 80s, and I can remember making a little sign after learning that Shell wouldn't divest from South Africa and going out in the Detroit cold by myself with holding this sign, trying to discourage gas people from buying gas at Shell. At the time, I wouldn't do that now, because I now know that these independent places are owned by individuals. But yeah, I remember having that reaction to the awareness that Stevie Wonder and other people were doing about apartheid at the time. Octavia's work comes in much later for me. I'm in my 20s by the time I read, early 20s, like 20, 21, by the time I read Parable of the Sower, which I would say most relates to her activism, because she really has a vision for not just survival, but absolute transformation and change that you don't necessarily see in other post-apocalyptic and near-future novels and imagination.
So now, one of the things that you're known for is the documentary Black August, which is exploring the hip-hop culture and the hip-hop community. Do you see Afrofuturistic themes in hip-hop?
Well, Black August never ended up being released, so those people who were lovely enough to show up at screenings, and which they were all across the country, saw that. I think people know me more for having written Jay-Z's book Decoded, because Black August is definitely about political prisoners. I mean, we did this hip-hop concert that raised awareness about political prisoners in the United States. In terms of any kind of intersection of my interests, I don't organize using hip-hop as a tool or an element anymore. And I haven't done that since the Black August concert series, which I stopped doing in the early 2000s. So no, I'm not necessarily thinking about hip-hop at all in this way. I mean, in fact, so much of her work transcends these not just misogynistic but binary ways of thinking about things like gender.
So sexuality, no, gender.
All of, yeah, definitely. I would have loved if she'd... I mean, her death was a tragedy on so many levels, and selfishly, we usually, mourn people because we won't have what they will be around to give us. And for me, it's no different with Octavia. I definitely wish that Fledgling could have been completed. I know that she had plans to make that a trilogy.
I keep thinking that it's got to be somewhere. She's got to have notes somewhere that someone can take up Fledgling.
Right? Well, you know, she was huge on research. She died with all of those thousands of books in Seattle. So I think that the notes must be there in some way or another. Yes, you're right. Even if they're not her notes, I think the books that she was using to inform that writing are somewhere in her library.
And Fledgling is about a vampire series, but these are different type of vampires who have made use of melanin and can walk around in the sunshine.
Exactly. I mean, she definitely imagined them in a way that's different than we'd imagined them before. I mean, there are problems with that book. I'm sure Matthews has a very young body, and so she finds herself in role, even though she's hundreds of years old, and finds herself in these romantic relationships. I don't think she's hundreds of years old. She might almost be 100, but whatever. Yeah, so that book is interesting on a bunch of levels, and sexuality being just one factor.
I think one of the things that Octavia Butler did, as you mentioned, was deconstruct almost every construct that we embrace, from race, class, sexuality, the whole nine yards. And science fiction and fantasy is a unique medium to do that. And it makes you wonder why we as a culture haven't embraced that medium.
Well, I think that, I mean, it's not the longest history, but I mean, Delaney did, you know, it's been absolutely amazing. It's not as accessible as Octavia. She has a very plain way of writing that engages people on all levels. What Tanana Reeves has done to continue her legacy is amazing. And what my co-panelist, Adrienne Marie Brown, does to take this work and then train, you know, activists to use her concept, her ideas of distributive kind of leadership and justice, and again, her anti-hierarchical principles, which are at the core of all her work. I mean, I think there are interesting things that we'll see into the future for many, many generations to come that are a result of Octavia Butler's influence.
Well, you just mentioned the other two folks who had joined us this morning, Adrienne Marie Brown and Ms. Tana Reeve Du, who, as you mentioned, are both doing some groundbreaking things in that area.
So absolutely.
We want to thank you all. We want to thank you all for embracing this fantasy and science fiction and Afrofuturism and bringing it to us so that we can understand it at the symposium on April 16th.
Oh, I look forward to seeing you there. You sound like a huge Octavia Butler fan, so huge. I'm assuming you'll be there.
Everything that you mentioned, Octavia Butler, Madeline L. Engel, and The Wrinkle in Time, so everything. Well, Dream, we really do want to thank you for joining us this morning to talk about Octavia Butler. Yes, I am definitely a fan. And appreciate you all being here to talk with everyone about fantasy and art and activism.
Thank you so much for having me. I'll see you there.
We want to thank our guests this morning, Tanana Reeve Du, Adrienne Marie Brown, and Dream Hampton, all panelists who will be speaking at the Octavia Butler Art and Activism Symposium taking place at Spelman College on April 16th. If you want more information about that event, please visit spelman.edu. At The Local Take, we want to hear from you. Let us know what's going on in the community. Please call our community engagement line at 404-880-6211 about your community concern. Thanks again for joining us this Saturday morning. This is Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take on WCLK.